My mornings are chaos. I need coffee that works as hard as I do. That's why I drink Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's rich, delicious coffee boosted with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Everything I need for focus and balance, ready in 30 seconds. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
The short answer is no. Don't get accent reduction or accent enhancement. My motto is stay human, people. Stay human with all of this AI and really keeping humans at the center of communication. So should people get training for their accent? No.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. You are great at your job and gotten great performance reviews, and you have wide-ranging experience around the world. In fact, speak multiple languages. Given the nature of companies and work today, you are a shoe-in to have a great career, to get promoted, and to become a high-impact leader. Or so it seems. Because there's one sticking point. You are not a native English speaker, and while you are fluent in English, it's still your second or third language, so you've got one thing that's noticeable every time you open your mouth: your accent. And you feel, or have even been told, that your accent and spoken communication is impeding your career progress. Now, more than half my clients aren't non-native English speakers. It's their second or third language. And yes, they have accents when they speak English. And my clients at some point say, I feel like I'm getting penalized for my accent at work. Should I go through accent reduction training? And I've also heard this in other ways. I hear it from leaders who I coach about their teams that are around the world, when they say, I'd like to promote so-and-so, but their communication isn't there. They just don't sound like a leader. I've even experienced it in reverse myself. I'm fluent in Mandarin, Chinese, and Spanish, and spent most of my career working in companies and the countries where that's the primary language that we spoke. So that feeling of being on the other side when you say something, and it just doesn't seem to resonate with the people on the other side. So that's our topic today. We know that communication from previous episodes is a top leadership trait, and it's the most harshly judged. So how do you ensure your spoken communication lands as crisp, powerful, confident with native English speakers who tend to be bosses, leaders, HR, definitely in multinational and American companies, and they are the very people who decide who gets promoted? So I'm very excited today to have as my guest Peter Novak, the founder of the Strictly Speaking Group. He's a globally recognized communications coach, and his team has worked and coached thousands of rising stars to Fortune 50 execs at global companies to succeed in high-stakes communications. He's got this rare blend of academic rigor and training from the fields of linguistics, performing arts, cultural intelligence, and communication. Peter holds a doctorate from Yale in dramaturgy and is a former tenured professor at the University of San Francisco, where he was also co-founder of the Performing Arts and Social Justice Program. So is your accent getting in your way? And if so, what can you do about it? Peter, delighted and honored to have you here on 97% Effective. Welcome.
I'm really happy to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Your path, Peter, let's just start with this because it's really interesting. Where did your interest arise in communications, which kind of leads you into drama and performance in academia? And then you leave academia to start Strictly Speaking Group. And one of your focuses, a pretty big one, is helping non-native speakers. Walk us through that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'd always been interested in languages and culture and accents. Even when I was a kid, I used to pretend to be from a different place and walk around and talk to people in different accents. I think that's how I got into theater early on as a child and did degrees in acting, where my own accent was changed because I grew up in the Midwest of the United States. And I had a very flat sound, that sort of Midwestern sound, you know, the piaster and the parish staff instead of the pastor and the parish staff, which I was later trained out of, actually. And so I was made to feel that my accent, even in grad school and in acting school, was less than perfect, right? It wasn't what was called standard American English is what we learned to speak. And so that got me interested in figuring out how to really work with the different sounds of American English, what that meant, and how to work with accents in a way that was positive, how to really understand the bias that happens as a result of our accented speech. And so even in my voice and speech classes at the university, I focused in on sort of social justice aspects of language and how important it was to achieve as much equity as possible, not only in the classroom, but then in business places. And so I started coaching on the side as a professor and helping non-native English speakers, but also native English speakers, really feel more confident in their speech. And that developed into a company. And now we're, you know, out there in the world that we've been doing this for 10 years and working with wide ranges of people at a wide range of companies, too. We're sort of sector agnostic and helping them with both high stakes presentations, so when they go out on stage and speak to 5,000 people, or just in their own teams individually. So it's developed into a really lovely way of learning a lot about different businesses and different types of leadership skills, and then helping people feel more confident in their own voice. Mm.
It is such a fascinating background. As I was researching you, we're talking here language and communication, and people think English, Spanish, German. But you're fluent in another language, right? Sign language, American Sign Language. And you translated, or maybe done the only translation, of Shakespeare into sign language. Explain a little of that and how it's even, you know, informs you today.
Absolutely. I grew up next to the Michigan School for the Deaf and sat next to a friend who was deaf and learned sign language growing up. My oldest sister was deaf in her left ear. She never went completely deaf, but I started signing from a very early age and then decided for my master's degrees to translate some Shakespeare, just one scene or two from Shakespeare for my master's degree. And then when I did my doctorate in dramaturgy, an obscure field, it means basically storytelling, at Yale, I proposed to do the entire play Twelfth Night into American Sign Language. And so brought together a team of deaf actors and deaf dramaturgs and playwrights and hearing folks as well. We would sit down at a table and we would argue. This is the sign for argue. It's like one person shaking their hand at another person kind of going at it together. And we spent 2 years translating the play into sign language. And probably the most challenging and rewarding thing I've ever done in my life, because you have to take everything that is sound-oriented in Shakespeare, which is significant, and translate it into a visual and gestural language. And it's funny because a lot of people don't know that American Sign Language actually isn't English. It is a different, it's a completely different structure. Like, for example, if I said, are you going to the meeting in Chicago next week? In American Sign Language, I would put the time first and I would say, next week meeting Chicago, you go. And I will set up Chicago in space around me so that when I point to Chicago again, that's what it means. I don't have to say the sign Chicago. I just point to it and it stays there until we shift topics. And so sign language is this architectural language that is just stunning. And it's always in the present because it's in the body, right? And it's four-dimensional. It exists in time and space. So many aspects of sign language fascinated me. But I'm constantly reminding folks or informing folks that it's not English. It's a completely different language. And one of my favorite quotes is from an author, Julie Sedavy, who says, you know, in all the different languages that I speak, I feel like I'm a slightly different person. And I think those in your audience who are multilingual can relate to that, that maybe you, Michael, aren't as funny in Chinese as you are in English or in Spanish. Maybe you feel more confident in one language than another as a result. Maybe you feel really smart in one language and not as smart in another. And I think that's what's really interesting to me, is that feeling of being a slightly different person, even the way we behave slightly differently in different languages.
Yeah, that's such an interesting story and insight, because I do feel that, right? I feel different in those languages. And even over time, I've noticed that my hand gestures may change, or the tone or the cadence. I know this is things that you talk about. I'll start to adopt them either because I'm mirroring people or I'm finding they're more effective. Mm-hmm. Never totally understood why, but it sounds like a lot of this is the work that you do and you get us to think mm-hmm. about.
Yeah.
Which I don't want to bury the lead. So these two questions I asked at the beginning, which I do hear mm-hmm. from a lot of clients. The first one is, we're talking about a competent person. They do their
right.
job at the highest level.
Yep.
So the question straight up is there accent bias?
There is accent bias. And I think people will inherently recognize it and sometimes often feel it. And oftentimes it also comes from our own internal sense of self, right? We tend to maybe censor ourselves because of our fear of saying something in a meeting. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But yes, there is accent bias. There are some really interesting studies done out of McGill University in Canada that basically posed this question. If let's say your car has broken down, you're in a city that you don't know, you need to get to a garage because your phone battery is dead and you don't know where one is. So you ask two people. They send you in opposite directions, right? So they give you two different pieces of advice on where to go. Who do you believe? The person who sounds like you, a native speaker, whatever that native speaker speech is, or someone who sounds foreign or from an outgroup? Who do you tend to believe? And the answer is that we tend to believe people who sound like us more than we believe people who don't sound like us. And I think a couple of things. One is, for those of you who speak in a way that is from an outgroup from your region or your city or your company and things like that, they're often faced with the question, oh, where are you from, right? And that is a way of othering people immediately, of mm-hmm. saying, oh, you're not from here, wherever here is. And that question constantly reminds people, right, that they are other in some way. And so one of my campaigns is to try to stop people from saying, where are you from? There are so many other ways to get great stories out of people, like even saying, where's home for you? Or where's home for you now? Which can be a very different question and recognizes people's immigration statuses very differently. Yeah. And then people have a choice on how they want to answer. So that's one way that sort of bias just creeps into our normal daily conversations. The second is, you know, how we believe people or not. And that same McGill study was really fascinating because it said that you can reduce that gap in trust if you sound more confident in English. And my question always is, well, what the heck does confidence in English really sound like? right? Even if I asked native speakers, even if I asked you, Michael, what does confidence sound like in English? What would you say?
Feels pretty murky, right? Just,
yeah.
You know, it may not all be language either, but you say it point blank, right? Very definitively, direct.
Or directly, right. Right, see, this is the thing. And it's funny because execs or a lot of people will say, they need to be more confident. And that just, and if someone gives you that advice or feedback that you need to be more confident, reject it because it's not actionable.
Yeah.
There's no way, right? And it also reduces people's confidence because they're like, oh, I'm not confident. What the heck does that mean? And what do I actually do to do that? So that's the basis and the foundation of really thinking about this work is how do you speak in a way that meets the expectations of what native speakers are listening for? Mm. And that's the key, I think, in trying to really understand what confidence means in English and how to pursue it.
And so that idea of meeting the expectations of what others are perceiving, that leads to that second blunt question. Hey, should I go get accent reduction training? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, my response is, the short answer is no. Don't get accent reduction or accent enhancement, or there's a whole series of language around this. Now there's AI that works at call centers, for example, that will change the people who are calling. It will change their accent to model it more on who the listener is. My motto is stay human, people. Stay human with all of this AI and really keeping humans at the center of communication. So to answer your question on should people get training for their accent, no. There are some really simple, practical things that people can do to understand the way, and I can explain how native English speakers listen. And when I say that, I don't mean what's their communication style. It's not about that. It's about the brain science behind how English works different from other languages. And how, for example, we listen for in English. English is a stress-timed language. Spanish is a syllable-timed language. Mm. So the difference is that in English, we stress certain words to make more meaning. Let me give you an example. If I say, I never said we should fire him, right? You can stress different words and it has completely different meanings. If I say, I never said we should fire him, it means I didn't do it. You did it, Michael. You suggested we should fire him. If I say, I never said we should fire him, it means I'm saying I never said that. I completely reject that idea. If I say, I never said we should fire him. I might have hinted at it, but I didn't say it directly. I've never said we should fire him. I said, yes, discipline, but not fire, right? Or I never said we should fire him. We should fire her, right? Is yeah. Every time we stress a different word, it changes the meaning. And so what English, native English speakers are listening for are those content words, those 2 to 3 words per sentence that carry the most meaning and have the most weight to them. And by weight, I mean the way that you actually say them. Mm. You know, that you deliver it with more strength or with more vocal variation, right? That's what we as English, that's part of what we're listening for. And if you can think about those content words, and there's a way to do that in a structure that I can talk about,
yeah,
we can go into, that really helps people do that. Once you understand the content words and the musicality, basically what we're talking about is something called prosody.
Hmm. Yeah, say prosody that word, I came across it. What does that mean?
Yep. Yeah, so prosody, think about that, is the musicality of the language. Mm. Every language has its own musicality, the way that the intonation works, mm-hmm. the way that you pause, the rhythm of the language, all of those extra linguistic things that are not the words themselves. It's what goes on top of those words that carry meaning, intention, so many other aspects of how we communicate. And so understanding the music of how we speak, as well as the strength and power behind it. One of my best recommendations is to get a good microphone, because I can't tell you how many Zoom sessions I've been. This is the most practical advice I give.
Yeah.
Get a good microphone. I am in so many corporate Zoom sessions with people who have really bad audio, and it's really echoey. It's difficult to hear them sometimes. And one of the best things you can do for clarity's sake is to get a good microphone. Makes a huge difference for everyone, because then you can use your NPR voice if you want, your radio voice. You don't have to yell. The musicality of your voice can come through because the audio is picking it up in a really clear way.
Yeah. This is fascinating. Your flat out answer, right, is no, you don't need to do the accent reduction. Think right. about things more broadly. And when it comes to accents, you say it's not an accent, it's an identity. Yep. And as I thought about that and I dug into your research, I found it really profound. Can you just say what you mean by that?
Yeah. So a couple of things. One is the data show that multilingual speakers are better at many different dimensions, like task switching, right? They're better at moving between two different types of tasks, one that's more analytic and one that's more deductive, you know. They're better at memorizing things, remembering things. They're better at so many things that we take for granted that monolingual people aren't. And the reason I say it's not an accent, it's an identity, that actually came from a client who talked about the power in his native accent. And he spoke both Indian-accented English, as well as American-accented English. And it was really interesting, because when I asked him to try and speak in his Indian accent, he couldn't do it because I wasn't Indian. I wasn't a member of that community, and so he couldn't speak it with me. And he found himself naturally going back and forth between the two. In fact, even in one sentence, his wife is American, his mother, of course, is from India. And so he would start the sentence by looking at his mother and speaking with an Indian accent. And as he turned his head and started to look at his wife, he ended the sentence in an American accent. And he was the one who talked about the strength that he feels, the power that he feels in his Indian accent. It feels more powerful to him. And that's when he said, it's not an accent, it's an identity, and I am attached to it. And we are, because it's who we are, which is why accent reduction, accent enhancement, whatever you want to call it, isn't the way to go, because it embodies who we are. We're never going to be able to change, right, to sound native. Why try? What you want to do is sound clear and effective and make sure people understand what you're saying. That's it. And so it's such a crucial part of who we are. That's why I think that Julie Sedevi quote about feeling different in different languages exposes the authenticity of how we sound naturally, and not wanting to, you know, not feeling that you have to change it, because it is who we are. And you know, I felt that when I was in graduate school, when my Midwestern accent was sort of made fun of. And I think a lot of us, even in our first languages, might be accented in a way that is not privileged in that culture, right? There's lots of accent bias around the world in every country and in every language.
I did see some fascinating research that you referenced that came out of Canada that did look at, you know, language learners, separating them into groups, some that were more focused on accent, others that were focused on structure and cadence and these other things, and another control group. And that really came to show that accent didn't help.
Right.
Is that the outcome of that study? I thought it was very useful to look at.
It is. It's that the macro linguistic thing. So how fast you speak, the vocal variation and the tones that you use, focusing on content words like we discussed earlier, and then pausing. Now, a lot of people, if you're a fast talker, you're not a fast talker, Michael, but there are a lot of fast talkers out there. If you're a fast talker in your first language, chances are you're a fast talker in your second or third languages as well. Spanish, for example, is a really fast language. One that's even faster is Japanese. And so what happens is that non-native speakers often get told for advice just to slow down. That doesn't really help. What helps is if you pause within the sentence, and if you pause around what are called thought clusters. Hmm. Thought clusters are a group of words that naturally belong together. Now, that sentence that I just said, I didn't say thought clusters are a group of words that naturally belong together. I said thought clusters, pause, are a group of words, pause, that naturally belong together. And can you tell how different it is when I put those brief pauses in there?
Yeah.
I'll do it again just to show the difference. Thought clusters are a group of words that naturally belong together. Thought clusters are a group of words that naturally belong together. And what happens is it just those pauses in those thought groups allows us to follow you more easily. And so that's another way to, instead of just slowing down, it's to change the rhythm internally of a sentence. You can still be fast in other sentences, but varying your pace is more interesting and makes people listen to you more as a result.
And they'll listen to you if you do that, even if it's layered with an accent.
Correct. That's absolutely right. That's the key, is that these pauses, emphasizing content words, and we'll talk about a way to do that more effectively, and then intonation. And intonation is one of my favorite things. In English, we have different ways of ending a sentence. The downward inflection signals strength. Now go, right? And I'm done, right? It signals completion and finality. The upward inflection, it sounds like a question, and you can use it actually very effectively in a sentence without asking a question. So for example, you might say, and intonation, it's really important to focus on that at times. Say, I used it there in the middle of, and intonation, let's focus on that for a moment, right? You can hear it in the middle of a sentence, but I'm not asking a question. When you use it at the end of sentences too much, that decreases your confidence in others and how they listen. And then the third inflection is perhaps my favorite, and it's called the sustained inflection. Since you speak Chinese, it's the one tone in Chinese. It's on a, so, right, that example, it trains our ear. We're thinking, what? So what's coming next? What am I listening for? I'm listening either for downward or upward, and it's not there yet. And so it allows you to sound like you're thinking in the moment.
Yeah.
And that's the key to sounding spontaneous. One of my favorite things is to teach people how to read from a text, but make it sound spontaneous. And if you can learn that skill, which we teach in our workshops, it is life-changing for folks. Because then, if you're a non-native speaker, you can actually write things down and have AI help you.
Yeah.
And then read from it in a way that makes it sound like you're just speaking off the cuff or speaking spontaneously. And then you're not worrying about what you're saying, because non-native speakers are oftentimes sometimes translating in the moment. They are sometimes rethinking vocabulary. And in the moment, they're thinking about what to say as well as how they're delivering it. And so they are thinking a lot more than native speakers do as a result. They're processing more, right? Their cognitive load is higher as a result.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, Executive Coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
And so, Peter, what you just shared right there of laying out the speech, almost I'm envisioning kind of like you're scoring it. I was just recently taking a Mandarin fine tune where we were less thinking about the accent and more about the grouping, the parsing is what our instructor called it. It does fly in the face of conventional advice of remember two bullets and not memorize, but go with the flow.
Yeah, exactly. So let me parse this out a little bit more because I think it's really helpful. Let's say you've got a presentation that you're doing. Oftentimes, the way people prepare for presentations is they do exactly that. They look at their slides and they kind of go through it mentally in their minds. This is what I'm going to say. They don't practice it out loud. And practicing out loud is one of the best things you can do. And instead of just doing a practice out loud on your own, do it with AI. So what I mean is have it record in a speech-to-text app. Otter is a really good example. Otter also is trained on a wide range of accents. And so it detects more faithfully what you're saying. But just do it once out loud. Practice your speech out loud. And then when you do that, you've got a text. You've got your script already because you've just practiced it out loud. And now all of a sudden, I've got the script. And you can start to read through it and say, oh my goodness, that's not very clear. Oh, I could say this better. Oh, this doesn't work. There's no transition here between my slides. All of these things. Upload your talk to AI. Ask it to generate a voice print for you. In other words, to make it sound like you. You don't want to change the speech so much so it doesn't sound like you. You say, analyze my speech and determine my rhythms, things that I say over and over again. In fact, we've got a prompt that we give people for this. And generate, you know, what I'm saying, again, making it clear. Use global English, which doesn't use jargon, doesn't use metaphors, right? To make it clear for everybody. Put in good transitions. Give me a hook at the top and a nice call to action at the end of my presentation. And all of a sudden, AI will give you a wonderful script within 30 seconds that you can then use. And when you're delivering it virtually, what I do is I take the script and I narrow the margins to just 2.5 inches wide. So the text is only 2.5 inches wide. And I put the text right under my camera. And so I can read from it and make it sound like I'm not reading, and people won't see my eyes scanning back and forth, left to right or top to bottom. And what I do for scoring it, and that's the exact right language, Michael, is I will underline or bold the 3 or 4 most important content words in that sentence, in each sentence. And then I put in slash marks for those pauses that we're talking about internally around thought clusters. I'd love it if AI could do that for us. Maybe if I could train AI to do that
it
for
is the
scripts,
next step.
Actually. It is the next step. So I'm working on. And then you can put in some question marks where you want to ask those questions, right? You're switching topics or you're highlighting something, asking a question and answering it yourself. It's a great way to include different types of rhythm, of speaking. And then what you're doing is that you're actually focusing on delivery. You're focusing on the intention and the meaning rather than on thinking about what it is that you're saying.
Right.
I could even give you an example of how to make it sound spontaneous.
Yeah. What would be an example if you've got one there?
Yeah. Let me pull up a TED talk that I love by Stephen DeBerry. And it's a great talk on why the wrong side of the tracks, right, tend to be on the east side of places. And so I've got it up on my screen now. I don't know. I know you can see me. And so I'm gonna read it. Mm-hmm. But I want you to listen to what I do to make it sound like it's spontaneous. All right, here we go. You know, I came to talk about first principles and communities that I love, especially East Palo Alto, California, which I think is just full of amazing people. Now, it's also a community that's oddly separated by the 101 freeway that runs through Silicon Valley. And on the west side of the freeway and Palo Alto are the haves on just about any dimension you can think of, education, income, access to water. And on the east side of the freeway are the have-nots. Did it sound like I was reading to you?
No, because you kept kind of periodically adding, it sounded like, in the moment you were kind of thinking of what was coming next.
That's exactly right. Thinking about what's coming next. Mm-hmm. And so vocally, what I was doing is I did a few things. One is I repeated a few words. I would say, and the thing about this, and the thing about this, right? That makes us sound spontaneous, like we're thinking. The other thing is I used a sustained inflection to to sound like, right? We do this in all languages. You do it in Chinese, you do it in Spanish. You elongate a sound because you're thinking of what's coming next. Mm-hmm. Pues, right? In Spanish, you, and that's what makes it sound like we're thinking as well. So basically, the delivery just makes it sound like you're in the moment by doing these repetitions, by adding other words to the text. You're not confined by the text. It's a script that you can vary when you speak. And then I used all different intonations when I was talking about a list, for example. I said, the haves have education, income, access to water, right? You can hear the way my tone works on that when I'm doing a list. And so when you add all these things together, the spontaneity with the scoring of the script, with which words to highlight, it becomes an incredibly clear way to deliver.
Yeah. And it lands with the audience.
Absolutely.
In those settings.
Because then you're not really thinking about what you're saying. You're focusing on how you're delivering it to others. And that makes the meaning clearer for folks.
Yeah.
And then you feel spontaneous at the same time, even though you're reading from a text. It's a fantastic way to do things in virtual meetings.
Yeah. Peter, I also wanted to ask you, we've been talking up to this point around preparing and delivering your communication. Mm-hmm. And you do also, when we spoke, have independent of your communication with someone, other things that you can do, very strategic, clever, and smart. And I do some of these things with my clients, but it was a really rich area of ways that you can also set yourself up or expectation setting, et cetera. Can you just share a little bit about why that's important and maybe an example or two?
You bet. So a couple of things is that native speakers often forget that multilingual speakers are processing differently. Mm. And so let's say you're in a Q&A session and someone asks you a question and you need a little bit of extra time to think. You can say, you know, give me just a minute. I want to structure my thoughts because I'm still translating from Mandarin. Right?
Yeah.
And what that does is a subtle reminder to the you know, language dominant folks, the English first folks, is that you're actually doing some heavy lifting that's different. I don't know if you remember Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, you know, the dancers from the 1940s films. The quote always was about Ginger Rogers, that she's doing everything Fred Astaire's doing, only backwards and in high heels, right? And I think it's the same metaphor for multilingual speakers, is that they're doing a lot more in terms of brain processing and power. So that's one way. One way is to remind people subtly that you are multilingual and that you're doing some things differently. Laura Huang, she is a professor. She's got a great book called Edge. And what she does is she recommends that you take, for example, something that people might think, let's say she gives an example of an Asian American woman who some people might think is more quiet, and maybe she is to take that difference and to turn it around and flip it around and make it a strength. So let's say that person's interviewing. You might say something like, you might think that I'm a quiet person, and to some extent I am, but let me tell you about how my recent negotiations with this team yielded some great results. And what you do is you're flipping that around and thinking about someone that might have bias towards you in a specific way and saying, no, here's the strength that I bring to this team, or here's what it is. So you're acknowledging the bias in a subtle way and then making it your strength. And I think that's a really powerful way to do it. In fact, she cites studies that say when people do that, they are deemed to be more interpersonally effective than people who don't do that. So that's really effective. Another thing that I love is to use idioms from your own language when speaking. So a friend of mine who's from Argentina started saying, the chicken is ready and the hen is plucked. Listo el pollo y pelada la gallina is what he would say.
And you have an Argentinian accent.
That's when you speak. He's Argentinian, so exactly.
When you speak Spanish, you have an Argentinian accent. I can pick that up right away.
That's exactly right. I do in that quote. I don't normally, but that brings up really interesting questions around neutral Spanish. What is neutral Spanish? Yeah. What isn't? And how power works in that idea of neutral Spanish. But But what he started doing is he started saying, you know, listo el pollo y pelada la gallina. And he would translate and say, hey, the chicken is ready, the hen is plucked, meaning that we've just shipped a product, no more changes to it. The chicken is ready, the hen is plucked, we are done. Yeah. And what happened is his team started using that phrase. Yep, chicken is ready, hen is plucked, we're not changing anything anymore, right? And so using part of your own culture and identity and idioms can become a really great way for the team to know that you're multilingual and to respect those cultural differences.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a really fun way to do something like that.
Yeah, that reminds me of a previous interview I had where we were talking about outsider-insider status and how it can be very difficult to ever become fully insider and very strategic to play to your outsider
That's exactly right.
Status.
Yep.
So those are some very savvy things to do. Very savvy.
I agree. I think they help with cultural intelligence, with people remembering that you're different. And then there's the whole realm beyond thinking of your speech and delivering it into the differences that we have interculturally, right, with how we communicate. Does the team or does your executive want your thinking first, your rationale be before a recommendation, or do they want the recommendation first?
Yeah.
And so many different ways, direct versus indirect, and understanding, you know, how we communicate, high context versus low context, all of those cultural dynamics that I think are really important and play into how we communicate cross-culturally.
And how, Peter, on that, to get real practical, is that kind of be an anthropologist and observe how the leader is speaking, or is that something just ask them directly? It seems like a combination could work here, but what do you find or recommend is most helpful? And obviously there is clearly you're drawing from research in terms of how certain cultures or styles may operate, but what are ways that people can get to that?
Absolutely. So one of the things I do actually when I'm with an executive is I ask them a series of about 24 questions, which is how they like to receive information. Yeah. Do you want a pre-read? Yeah. How do you want the pre-read organized? How do you usually make decisions? When if something's high risk, how do you want people to present it? And so I go through a list of all these questions so that the executive can say, this is what I want, this is what I want, this is what I want. And that takes away the guessing from people who are there. You can do it in a variety of ways. One is you can ask others who presented to that person, how are they going to be in the meeting? Are they going to ask me a lot of questions up front? Are they going to be silent? Are they going to confront me? Are they going, you know, and if you can prepare for that in advance, you'll be in a much stronger place when you're actually there with the executive. What's happening now is that ChatGPT-5, for example, has been programmed with cultural intelligence. So what you can do is you can say, look, I'm from Scotland, or I'm from India. I'm presenting to a team in Singapore. They're mostly comprised of this team. This is what we're doing. However you want to structure it, you can give that information to ChatGPT and it will make recommendations based on cultural intelligence on how you present to them. And there's some other really good models too for when communication breaks down that you can type into. There's one called from Arjan Verdoren, who has written a great book on this. It's called Cultures Don't Meet, People Do. Hmm. And it's a whole system that he's programmed into this AI to help you understand when communication breaks down. Was it the power differential? Was it the words you used? Was it the relationship changed? What was it that actually happened? And it gives you a list of things to think about next time when you're communicating with folks. So very, very helpful.
Yeah, these are fascinating tools. And I know you have a list of those and you have a short course around this.
Yep.
And
I
would just also point out here, I think this is one of the things that's incredibly rich and useful, which is while we may be talking about non-native speakers and things they can do, this applies for the person with the engineering background who talks in numbers, who's talking to the executive who wants emotional stories. And so,
exactly,
you know, being able to think about these techniques and strategies of how you land with your audience certainly makes you a better communicator and more effective.
Agreed. Absolutely.
One last thing
that I think is really helpful is to think in structures. Answer in groups of three if you can. Right? So someone asks you questions like, you know, there are two important things to remember about this. First is this, second is this. And when you signpost like that, you're actually making it more memorable for people. And so that's another thing to think about. And I find that non-native speakers often say more or speak longer because they're not sure that their message has landed. And so what they end up doing is rephrasing or paraphrasing again and again to make sure their point is understood. When you structure your comments first in your mind, it only takes a couple of seconds to think of a structure. My favorite is what, so what, now what? What is the point that I'm making? Why is it important? And what's next? When you do that, clarity also increases. So lots of different techniques, both for clarity of speaking, but also clarity of thinking and how you present it.
I love the fact that our conversation started with this narrow focus on accents and, you know, recognized it, but put it in its kind of place in terms of the larger order of things that will really drive and improve your communication, period, and make us more effective. So we started there, we ended here, but we're getting to the place. Peter, a quick lightning round, if you're open to that, of a couple of questions for you, because I just really enjoyed our conversation. On these topics, and you've got multiple streams, is there a book, article, thinker that you would point us to and say, this is a person who's really shaped your thinking a lot and advanced your thinking?
Yeah, you know, the one that I just mentioned, Arjan Verdoren, Cultures Don't Meet, People Do, and which is really about thinking about how you're one-on-one with somebody and what your communication really means and starting to analyze it, you know, among five dimensions. And that has really, I think, shaped the way I think about cultural intelligence, actually, very differently. Because in the past, we used to think about all these differences between direct and indirect and all those other things. But what Arjan is saying is like, no, you're dealing with a very specific person in this moment. And the more you can understand who they are and what their needs are and their worldview, and the better your communication will be. So it's really about getting to know your audience as well as you possibly can.
And the other is a question I want to get from you, a year and a country. But basically, in my mind, I've always thought about this being multilingual and global, that we will kind of truly arrive when a singer produces a song in three or four languages that are all appearing because certain languages express certain things better. And that becomes a global hit. I'm curious when you think that will arrive and what country that will the person will have been from.
Well, for music, it would probably come from Latin America. I have a feeling. I think what's happening is that English is becoming less dominant. English will become less dominant because what's going to happen is we're going to have these incredible tools that will allow us to communicate. Do you know, have you ever seen Star Trek? There's something called a universal translator in Star Trek. And that is that all these, you know, people from different planets come together, but whenever they're on the Enterprise or whenever they're speaking to people, they're all speaking English. And that's because they have a universal translator connected in their badges. And I think we're getting to this place where we're going to have a less dominance of English, and people's first languages are going to become just as important. And we're going to have these translation devices going in between. So it's a little different response to your question about what, you know, what the music will be, but I think it's coming very soon because all these advances in the way that we're communicating are going to change everything. That's why I keep saying stay human.
Keep
the humans at the center of communication, but use the technology where it advances clarity and meaning and connection.
Yeah. I love it. And fantastic to end on that note. Anything else that you want to add as we come to an end here?
I think that's it. You know, it's not an accent, it's an identity. I just keep remembering that. It's one of your superpowers, is your multilingualism. There's a lot of advantages to being multilingual, and so use it to your advantage.
Yeah. And if people are interested in seeing more of your work, reaching out to you guys, what's the best way to connect
with us on LinkedIn, actually. Our website is strictlyspeakinggroup.com. www.thebestofthebest.com. You can reach out there as well. And yeah, the website would be the best way to do that. StrictlySpeakingGroup.com.
Yeah. Peter Novak, the founder of Strictly Speaking Group. Thank you. Been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks, Michael, so much. I really enjoyed being here. Take care.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.